from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. 12 days after Governor Gavin Newsom announced a statewide stay-at-home order, the San Francisco Bay Area said it plans to extend its shelter-in-place rules through the end of April. Many Californians are now adjusting to the new normal of being physically distant while trying to stay socially connected. And some are also adapting to spending way more time than they used to with people in their households. We hear how you're managing these different relationships under shelter at home and get advice from a panel of experts. Join us. This is special statewide coronavirus coverage from KQED. I'm Mina Kim. So much has changed over the last few weeks. As former U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy writes in his recent piece for The Atlantic, quote, elderly residents of nursing homes are missing family visits. Children cannot play and learn alongside their classmates and friends. So much that we all took for granted, meals with friends, office banter, cheering at a game, worshiping with a community, is suddenly on hold. While the stay-at-home order for some has meant not seeing friends and loved ones at all, for others it's meant learning to spend 24/7 with those in their households. In this hour, we want to hear how you are managing the changes and what have been the biggest challenges. The number to join the conversation is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also reach us on Twitter, Facebook at KQED Forum, or email forum at kqed.org. And let me tell you who is with us. Dr. Vivek Murthy, former Surgeon General of the U.S. and author of Together, The Healing Power of Human Connection in a Sometimes Lonely World. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Murthy.
Glad to be with you again, Mina.
Also with us is Dr. Jonathan Cantor, Director of the Center for the Science of Social Connection at the University of Washington. Hello, Dr. Cantor.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
And Lydia Denworth is with us. She's a journalist and author. Her book is Friendship, The Evolution, Biology, and Extraordinary Power of Life's Fundamental Bond. Thanks for being with us, Lydia Denworth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Murthy, I'd like to start with you. I was intrigued by this point that you had made, that you're concerned that this period of physical distancing could usher in a social recession. What do you mean by social recession?
Well, Mina, much of the discussion that we've been having as a country on how to respond to COVID-19 has focused on the immediate impact on our health and also on the economic impact that may result as a result, frankly, of us not being able to go to work. But there's another impact I think we haven't talked nearly as much about, and that's the impact of the stay-at-home orders and other behavioral changes on our social connections with each other. The reason I use the term social recession is I think of this a social recession as a fraying of social bonds that threaten to further unravel the longer we go without human interaction. And what we're seeing right now is that many people have had to significantly change their social interaction and diminish their social interaction. The big question on people's minds is how long will this last? And the truth is, while we don't know for sure, it is unlikely to be just for another week or two. This will likely be a state that we're going to have to live in probably for a couple of months.
Yeah, and how long? The fact that there isn't a clear end date, I think, even adds to the anxiety of the situation, Dr. Murthy.
It does, and this is an extremely difficult time for everyone. I think for parents who are trying to figure out how to telework and take care of their kids at home and homeschool them, for children who are trying to figure out how to make sense of this new normal, for people who are vulnerable, particularly for the elderly who may rely on others for help, this can be a difficult time. My own grandmother, who's 90 years old, just fractured her hip a few weeks ago and is now finally back home after her rehab process. But she cannot go to rehab now because that creates a risk. You know, she is living at home with my father and my sister, who are primary care doctors, and they're worried about putting her at risk when they come home after seeing patients. And so this has created a very challenging period for everyone where we're questioning how we should interact, even with people who are the members of our own family who we've been living with for many, many years. And so I think this is there's a lot to figure out here. There's a lot that we're going to have to deal with over the next couple months. But I also think that there's an extraordinary opportunity in what's happening right now, an opportunity for us to refocus on how important our social connections actually are. And when you look at the science of social connection, it becomes quickly evident that our level and degree of connection in our lives is deeply connected to our health and to how we show up at work, in school, and for our families. And so I think we can potentially use this as an opportunity to recenter on those connections, to reach out to people that we may not have normally reached out to, old friends, extended family members, and to really focus on how to deepen those relationships in this time of crisis.
Yes, because Lydia Denworth, I mean, what happens to us physically? What happens to our brains when we are socially connecting?
Well, when we are socially connecting, our brains, huge swaths of our brains light up, the communication parts of our brain. So what's known as the social brain, which turns out to be a lot of what's going on under the skull. And but also more importantly for health, it's those social connections, they have a knock-on effect. So ultimately, either being connected or not being connected and being isolated can affect your cardiovascular functioning, your immune system, your stress responses, your cognitive health, your mental health, and even the rate at which your cells age and your mortality.
You know, that reminds me, Dr. Kanter, of something that you were saying in terms of what people are experiencing right now. And in some ways, this loss of connection is a form of loss itself.
It's one of many losses people are potentially experiencing right now across financial losses and other human losses. And the social isolation and the social connection probably is one of the most significant of all the losses. But I also think it's important to recognize that the concern about loneliness is something that we just aren't sure how it's going to play out right now. Almost all of our past research on loneliness, for example, is on people who are experiencing loneliness in the midst of a social group that is functioning as a group. In other words, it's a mental thing where you feel excluded from the group. And what's happening right now is the entire group, the entire community is excluding together. And at least in our initial look at some of the data that we're collecting here in Seattle, people initially were feeling a real sense of solidarity and community with each other, even as they were socially isolating. So it's a little hard to figure out exactly who's experiencing what losses right now amidst all the complexity of this moment.
That's so interesting. Dr. Murthy, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, being as concerned about loneliness as you are, I'm sure this whole pandemic must have felt initially just like a massive threat to our health and a threat to our ability to address what you described as this already existing pre-pandemic reality of loneliness. But if we're all going through it together, is that an opportunity?
I think it is an opportunity. And I think the point Dr. Kanter is making is a good one, that in moments of crisis, solidarity can be one of the results, and that can actually bring us closer together. I think about 1992, when Hurricane Andrew swept through South Florida, when I was in high school living here. And, you know, it was an extraordinary moment for all of us of great trauma, great loss. But we pulled together in extraordinary ways, got to know neighbors we had never known before, helped strangers and received help from strangers and felt more a part of a community than we ever had before. And that was a great gift of Hurricane Andrew, as deep and as painful as the losses were. One of the challenges I think we face here is what will happen to the solidarity that we're feeling now as this goes on for weeks and potentially for a few months. Will we be able to sustain that? Will we find ways to not just sustain, but even expand and deepen the relationships that we have right now, even though we can't physically be with each other? And I think that the answer to these, while it's up in the air, I think there's a real possibility that we could maintain this sense of solidarity, that we could deepen our connections with other people, but it depends on the choices that we make right now. It depends on how we choose to spend or not spend time with people. One of the things that has been striking to me in the work that I've been doing on loneliness and some of the research for the book was a recognition that small steps can make a big difference when it comes to how connected we feel. If we, for example, spend just 15 minutes a day reaching out to somebody that we love, ideally seeing them on video conference so we can see their face and hear their voice, or talking to them on the phone, or even writing them just to say, hey, I'm thinking about you. That short period of time, when done consistently over weeks or months, can make a big difference in how connected we feel to other people and to the outside world. It's really striking, but especially in an era like this, where we are not just busy at baseline, but even more busier now because we have to take care of our kids and so many other challenges. It's reassuring to me that a small amount of time can go a long way, and we can also improve the quality of our time. You know, in the multitasking world in which we live, it is very common for people to be catching up with a friend on the phone while they're also checking their social media feed, refreshing their inbox, looking at the news, searching for something on Google. And we tell ourselves we can multitask, we're still paying attention, but science is very clear that we can't, that we actually switch from task to task very rapidly, but that diminishes the quality of our interaction. This, I think, is an opportunity to not only spend a little bit of time at a basic level every day with the people we love, but also to make sure that's high quality time without distraction, without technology, because one of the greatest gifts that we can give another person is the gift of our full attention.
I'm glad you're moving us into advice, because I'd also love to hear from you, Jonathan Cantor, about what tips you have for creating the kinds of opportunities that Dr. Vivek Murthy is talking about in terms of dealing with loneliness and strengthening social bonds and extending our solidarity for what could be months to come.
I think Dr. Murphy's point is right on. As far as I'm concerned, there are so many little things we can be doing on a daily basis to connect with others. And one of the things I've observed is just how creative and innovative people are right now in finding these solutions on their own and using social media in all of these really beautiful ways. So a lot of this, I think, is letting people figure it out for themselves and encouraging people to be creative. But that said, I think there are definitely some tips and advice we can give people. For example, you can think of somebody you haven't connected with in a few years, somebody who perhaps you've lost contact with for one reason or another. Just imagine right now picking up the phone or somehow connecting over social media and just reaching out to that person and saying, hey, how are you doing? I'm thinking of you. You'll probably have some obstacles show up in your mind and body that will interfere. Thoughts that maybe this person doesn't want to speak to you anymore and so forth. And I think we can get better at feeling those obstacles, feeling that anxiety, feeling all that avoidance, and leaning in and reconnecting anyway, just bringing all that stuff along with us, along the ride with us, and actually talking to others about it because they're probably feeling the same things. So I think there are a lot of private obstacles that get in the way that we can work on overcoming right now.
And what's a gratitude intervention? I like that because that gave some structure to the interaction.
Yeah, so there's some really nice research on gratitude, where brief gratitude interventions can not only help the person to whom you're expressing the gratitude, but can actually help you feel better, improve your own relational and psychological well-being. And it can actually be a fairly simple thing. Again, just think of somebody right now who has treated you kindly or helped you in the past, but maybe you never really fully thanked them or expressed appreciation. You can spend 3 minutes right now writing down an appreciation or thanking them and then send it to them, or even better, contact them over the phone or in video chat and share your gratitude with them. You'll be surprised at how just 3 or 5 minutes of this can really transform how you and the other person feel. You'll feel more connected. You'll suddenly have oxytocin coursing through your system instead of cortisol, and all sorts of benefits that can last for quite a bit.
Well, listener JD tweets, as someone in quarantine for almost 4 weeks now, I'm actually speaking with friends and family members across the country more than usual. As a replacement, how does virtual connection fare against actual physical connection? Lydia Denworth, what do you think?
You know, what's really interesting about this is that there's a lot of work There's not that much science, in fact, on the social media question, and I had been doing a lot of reporting about that in the last year. What we don't know is how the extent to which it can replace in a meaningful way the kind of connection we get one-on-one. And we know how important that face-to-face contact is. Most people suspect, and it's intuitive, that active use of, say, video conferencing or, you know, talking to someone as opposed to just scrolling through a feed. I mean, there is work that shows that active use of social media as opposed to passive use is better for you. It's also true that there was beginning to be some new research showing that social media in general on a population level is not as bad for our well-being as we've been led to believe. There's been quite a lot of hysteria that I think is overblown. That doesn't mean that there aren't some negatives, but what's happened now is that we've rewritten the script on social media and digital technology dramatically in the space of weeks. And of course, it's because it's what we have. But I was just speaking with a neuroscientist who had been trying for the last 3 years to get funding to look at whether loneliness in the brain, and she's actually managed to identify loneliness in the brain as a craving that looks like hunger as well, which is a theory that psychologists have had for a long time, but it's the first time in humans that anyone has shown that. She also wanted to test the obvious next question of whether social media connection, whether and how social media could alleviate that. And she didn't get any funding for that, which of course is the great irony. Now it's what everyone wants to know. But most people seem to think that, you know, this is not the same, but it's really terrific that we have this now and that we should be using it as creatively and innovatively as we are.
That's so interesting. So you're talking about how pre-pandemic we were often lamenting the loss of face-to-face communication and talking about how people were losing social skills or their ability to engage with others, right, with like small talk or things like that. And now that it's our only option, we're all trying to figure out how to make the best use of these tools that we originally accused of sort of deteriorating connection. But so, I mean, you bring up a few potential options here. I mean, it sounds like face-to-face is better than not. Phone calls are probably better than texting, I assume. And I think what's also interesting, this listener, Jen, writes, I reached out to my neighbors for a physical distancing block party Sunday. Maybe four families came out at different times on our street, and we were all glad to be outside to have face-to-face conversations. I mean, I think one of the things that is happening, and Dr. Murthy and Dr. Cantor were saying is possible, is that you can actually deepen your relationships with people through this distancing process. And I know that you focused a lot, Lydia Denworth, on friendship. So can you give us any advice on how to do digital friendships well or friendship building well in the virtual space?
Yes, the thing I've been thinking about a lot is that the new science in the last 10 to 20 years on the biology and evolution of friendship, one thing it has succeeded in doing is helping us to define what friendship really is, because it's kind of a squishy idea. It's a thing where you think you know what it is, and at its sort of core, there are three main requirements. A friend is someone usually you have a long-lasting relationship with, so they're a steady, reliable presence in your life. It's someone that you have a positive relationship with that makes you both feel good. And it's someone that you have a reciprocal or cooperative relationship with. So there's a lot of give and take. And what I think is really important in thinking about how best to use digital technology to connect with your friends is to think about the ways in which what you do fall into any of those buckets. Like, are you being a reliable, steady presence? Are you showing up regularly? Are you affirming? So for instance, when Dr. Cantor was talking about gratitude, that is very affirming for a relationship and for a friendship, and appreciating, telling people that you care about them and that you value them and your time with them is really important. And then the reciprocal, the cooperative part, is one of the lovely things we're seeing communities really coming together to take care of those who are more vulnerable, to look out for each other. And friends are doing that for each other too, to the extent that they can. They're showing up from a distance. And to me, that's fundamentally what friendship is about. It's about being there for each other in a time when people need help. And so anything you do on social media can hit some of those categories and help to deepen the relationships, just as we've been saying in this conversation.
And you also say that it's almost like a core requirement of advancing as a human being.
I happen to believe that it is. It's been fundamental to our evolution as humans and in other species as well. In fact, work in other species where they have now recognized friendship or something like it is what tells us that this need to bond and to connect socially with other individuals is so fundamental, and then it's not just a cultural byproduct of human development. It's more basic than that. And in both humans and in other species, it turns out that the individuals that have the capacity to really make friends well, to have strong social bonds, they tend to do better. They live longer, and in baboons and macaques, they have more and healthier babies. And it's not just about being there to drive someone to the hospital, which is what they used to think in people it is. That's important. But baboons don't drive each other to the hospital. And so the fact that the baboons that have the better relationships live longer tells you that there's something more in the infrastructure of friendship that has helped us. So there's been a survival of the friendliest.
And again, Lydia Denworth is journalist and author of Friendship, the Evolution, Biology, and Extraordinary Power of Life's Fundamental Bond. We also have Dr. Jonathan Kanter with us. He's director of the Center for the Science of Social Connection at the University of Washington. And Dr. Vivek Murthy, a former Surgeon General of the U.S. and author of the book Together, The Healing Power of Human Connection in a Sometimes Lonely World. And you, our listeners, you're listening to a special statewide show on the coronavirus. And we're talking about how Californians are adjusting to the new normal of being physically distant, while also trying to stay socially connected, and also to the new normal of spending 24/7 with some members of the family that you didn't expect to, which I'd like to get into after the break. We're talking about how to boost your mental, emotional, and physical health while feeling stuck at home in some cases. You can call us at 866-733-6786 with your questions and stories. Again, 866-733-6786. You can tell us how you're coping and connecting, and even what the last nearly 2 weeks of isolation, at least from the statewide order, has taught you about your own resiliency. Again, 866-733-6786, and you can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. Okay, so Dr. Jonathan Kanter, what about the opposite side of this? I mean, there are new stressors on relationships when you're now spending basically every waking moment with them. Can you give us any thoughts on how to deal with that?
Well, I can first join in the struggle and admit that it's difficult. My wife and my 15-year-old daughter and I are suddenly on top of each other and negotiating space in ways that we never have before. And it's challenging. It's challenging for lots of people. I will say probably the one bit of advice I have real quickly to give is that it's really important to talk about potential conflict when you're not in the heat of the conflict. So to proactively predict what might go wrong, and to sit the family down and to try to come up with plans for how people are going to negotiate and cope before it happens. So
Good tip. We'll have more after the break. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to special statewide coverage of the coronavirus from KQED. We're talking about sheltering at home. You might be expecting stay-at-home orders to be extended, and already in the Bay Area, they have been. How has it been for you the last couple of weeks, and how are you preparing to face potentially many more weeks of this? We're hearing about your experiences and getting advice this hour about how to maintain healthy relationships with those we're physically distancing from, to those we may be spending way more time with than we used to. You can reach us at 866-733-6786 or online at KQED Forum on Twitter and Facebook. We've got Dr. Vivek Murthy with us, former Surgeon General of the U.S., Dr. Jonathan Kanter, Director of the Center for the Science of Social Connection at the University of Washington, and Lydia Denworth, journalist and author of Friendship, the Evolution, Biology, and Extraordinary Power of Life's Fundamental Bond. And let me go to a comment from Larry, who writes, "How do those of us who already live alone and have a history of depression and anxiety deal with this? I feel like one of my worst recurring nightmares has become my living reality. Do you expect suicides to go up? I find social media not much help." Dr. Vivek Murthy, do you have any thoughts for Larry?
Yeah, so I want to thank Larry for that question, because your question, I think, is one that applies to so many people. out there who were living alone before and now find themselves trapped in their apartments. And I do worry about how people are going to cope across the country. I do worry about people who are struggling with depression ahead of time, for whom social connection was a lifeline, and who may be struggling even more and now that they don't have the ability to get together. But I do think in these moments, when we know ahead of time that this is going to go on for some period of time, it makes it all the more important that we reach out, even if it's digitally, to our friends and to our family, almost with the same sort of ritual that we might apply to brushing our teeth or to, you know, taking a shower every day. I think it's important to build that kind of human connection into our life on a regular basis. And if we don't do that, then we can go days without human interaction in the current environment where we're told to stay at home. You know, I also think, though, that this is a time where it's extraordinarily important for us to be compassionate toward ourselves. People are struggling with a very, really unprecedented situation. And if you're a parent who's worried that your child is not doing as well with homeschooling after the first 4 days, and you just can't give them the attention that they need, if you're worried that you're not fully able to telework and pay attention to all the conference calls that are going on, this is not because you're deficient in some way. This is because we're all struggling with something that is extraordinarily painful, difficult, and new. And we will get better at this, but it's essential that we are compassionate toward ourselves. And one last thing that I would offer to Larry and to others who are concerned about the deepening isolation that may result from this moment is to recognize that one of the somewhat unexpected but powerful solutions to loneliness is actually service. It's helping other people. When we're lonely, especially for a long period of time, a few things happen which actually can deepen our loneliness even further. Just because of the nature of loneliness and how we've evolved as human beings, chronic loneliness makes us turn our focus inward, and we focus and are more preoccupied with ourselves. It also raises our threat level so that we are more suspicious or wary of people and circumstances around us. But it can also create this self-fulfilling prophecy where the longer we're lonely, the more we feel that it's our fault, or we assume that it's because we're not likable in some way. And the reality is that service is powerful because it helps us break that negative cycle. It enables us to connect with somebody in a very positive interaction while reminding ourselves that we have something of value to add to the world. And service doesn't have to be going to a soup kitchen or volunteering at a community organization, things which are harder to do now. Service can be reaching out to a neighbor who might be elderly or struggling to make sure they're okay. It could be reaching out to a work colleague who might be struggling to get work done and also take care of their kids to check on them or to drop off some food for them. Small acts of service can be extraordinarily powerful in helping us feel connected to others, and we need service more now than ever before.
Well, let me go next to Pamela in Santa Rosa. Hi, Pamela.
Hi. Thank you so much for this program, and thank you for the remarks just made about service. You know, I donated blood yesterday, and I walked out feeling so good because I have been very isolated. I'm on a low budget, and so when I use the computer, I use the library. If the library is closed, I have no internet access, and that has been a huge issue. I need to file for unemployment. I lost my job yesterday. There are other, you know, sites and references on the radio that say, go to this site, go to that site. I can do neither. I have no access to a computer, and I'm very uncomfortable about asking my neighbors if I can use theirs, you know, obviously in this climate. So how does one deal with that, perhaps? And then does anyone know how one could get a computer temporarily? You know, as I said, the library was my lifesaver, not only for technology, but for, you know, print media. So thank you. That's my question.
Pamela, thanks. Dr. Cantor, I'll start with you if you have any advice for Pamela.
Well, my heart breaks for Pamela and the situation and the difficulty of solving all these problems. I have a couple of bits of advice, but I also have to recognize that we, so many of us right now are facing problems that are difficult to solve. And this is one of them. I've talked previously here in Seattle a fantasy that Microsoft could get together with our public school system and make sure they donated a couple thousand computers to people who needed them right now because of the situation like Pamela's in. So I don't know that answer to that particular question, but I would like to say, Pamela, ask your neighbors. I know you're reluctant to, but you can ask them with that reluctance and maybe they could help. I think these sorts of obstacles get in the way. It's so important as we're struggling with hope and despair and problem solving to try the best we can to not do this alone and to reach out to whoever you can, whoever you feel is within your comfort zone to reach out to ask for help. It might not solve all the problems, but you won't be so alone in it as you're trying to solve the problems. And that's, I think, a really crucial piece of the puzzle right now.
I think one of the issues is if she's trying to use her neighbor's technology, she doesn't want to actually enter their home, right, because of social distancing rules. But you're making me think that right. Maybe a neighbor would be willing to lend a password or access to somebody's Wi-Fi signal.
There's ways to solve that problem, creative ways that would keep within the hygiene guidelines of social distancing and so forth. But it requires creativity and it requires people stepping out of their comfort zones and asking for help and trying to solve these problems together. The last thing I'd like to say here is, as we all feel the weight of these problems in our bodies and are struggling with what to do and inability to solve them, there's a difference between feeling that and slipping into real despair or depression. Part of what we have to struggle with right now is getting used to these feelings and trying to keep going day after day, try to have a good day today. You might not get all the problems solved, but at the end of the day, you can say, I did the best I can, and we wake up the next day and we try again. And human beings have great capacity to keep going in these situations. And I think that's really important, to not lose hope and to keep trying, to keep reaching out to others for help and for support.
Well, Pamela, thanks for sharing your story. I really appreciate it. Alex writes, honestly, the stay-at-home order hasn't changed anything for me, really. I already primarily only left home to get groceries or go to work and talk with friends online. Are we overreacting to this, or am I missing this isolation effect due to being online so often? What are your thoughts on that, Lydia Denworth? I'm wondering what your reaction to Alex is. I'm sure Alex is not alone.
Well, I think that what we're hearing, these kinds of stories and people's individual experiences show us the wide variety of experiences that people are having, not just now, but more relevantly, before this happened, the wide difference in how people live their lives. So some people are really socially connected, are out in the world all the time, and other people much less so. I mean, I'm someone who primarily works from home. And so, you know, the idea of working from home and being connecting with my colleagues virtually is normal for me. But I don't normally do it with my entire family right in the house with me, as other people have referred to. But it's also true that that there are plenty of people who live alone and who perhaps work from home, and then that is their primary. I mean, I think that for someone like Alex, perhaps it's fortunate that for those people, it doesn't feel as dramatic. I mean, I do worry a little bit about whether someone like that is getting enough social connection the rest of the time. But I think that, you know, the thing about friendship and social connection is that we do all have different sort of thermometers about it. When I say that friendship is a critical piece of being human, it isn't to say that everyone has to be friendly and social in the exact same way. Because loneliness, as was alluded to earlier, is really the mismatch between how much connection you want and how much you have. So it's a subjective feeling. And that is a different answer for each person. So I think in this, the problem is that there are many of us who are really struggling with this, and I think we'll only struggle more. This kind of reminds me of the way that everyone comes together if somebody dies. We referred to this earlier. All the casseroles come in and all the activity and the camaraderie, and then it's the weeks after when everybody goes away that get really hard. And I think in this case, it's going to be as the weeks pile up and people start to feel more and more cabin fever, you know, our responses will change. But so it may not be an overreaction for Alex, but it absolutely is devastating for other people. And you listen to someone like Pamela, whose life has just been torn apart by this. I mean, those two experiences are radically different.
Well, let me go to Pavel in Oakland. Hi, Pavel.
Hello there. Hello?
Yeah, you're on.
Oh, great. I'm just calling in just in regards to the caller who is seeking some kind of computer options available to her. There's actually a great nonprofit called Tech Exchange that's based in Oakland, and they provide free or low-cost computer options. You can obviously reach them through the website, techexchange.org, but you can actually text them right now at 510-866-2260. And, you know, they have limited staffing, but they'll often get it back to the person and just see what kind of online option they can hook her up with.
That's great. Thanks for the advice, Pavel.
Sure. My pleasure.
So there's a resource there. One of the things that I've been hearing is routine is so important, especially for kids if they're home with you. Why is routine so important, Dr. Murthy? Is it because it creates some degree of predictability at a time when there seems to be so little of it?
Yes, I mean, during times of great uncertainty, it's important that we have some structure, not just for kids, but for all of us, so that we have a foundation that we can lean on, so we at least know some of what's coming. So in moments like this, it's actually more important than ever to make sure that we are sleeping as we need to. We know how important sleep is for our health, but it's all the more important to be disciplined about getting rest. It's also important to build in practices that help us in terms of our body and our mind. So physical activity is essential, building in some time for contemplative practices like meditation or gratitude are very important. And the more we structure this in our life, the more we structure it for our children as well, the easier it will be for them to cope with the ever-changing situation around them. Questions like, how long is this going to take? How long is this going to last? What's going to happen with my school and my classes? There's a lot of unknowns, but we can help root ourselves in some certainty by building structure into our day. I would say, Mina, also the other piece I think that I'm reflecting on and just listening to this larger conversation is that I think what this experience is doing for us, this experience of social distancing and experiencing the loneliness and isolation that so many people are going through right now, is it's pulling the curtain back on a deeper well of loneliness that people have experienced for some time. And in my mind, there are two critical cultural questions that this raises that I think we have the opportunity to change. One is around the culture of vulnerability. You know, we have for too long, I think, in modern society, thought of vulnerability as a source of weakness. And we hesitate to be open with others. We don't want to be ridiculed or thought of as weak. But in this moment where so many of us are experiencing pain, I think it's all the more clear that it's our moments of vulnerability that give us the deepest opportunities to connect. It's those moments of being real with each other that end up being our most cherished moments and that strengthen our friendships. So I think we need to change how we see vulnerability, particularly for men and for young boys who we teach in our culture to be stoic, to not depend on anyone else. And we tell them that being vulnerable is a sign of not being manly. And second, there's another element in our culture, which I think is more insidious, but equally as dangerous, which is that I think that as much as we all may prioritize people in our life, the tenets and forces in the modern culture in which we live tell us that to be successful, to be worthy as a person, you have to achieve the acquisition of wealth, reputation, or power. Those three things are what constitute success and determine your self-worth. And the reality is that has crept in to our lives, so much so that it's edged out relationships. But I think this is an opportunity for us to say, what would it look like to build a people-centered life and a people-centered world? What would it be like to put people first? Where we design our workplaces and schools to strengthen connections, where we make decisions about where to put our time and energy so that they strengthen relationships in our life. If we do that, then I think we will come out of this entire ordeal stronger than when we began.
And for some people, at least, this has given them time that they never really had. How do we use this time to deepen existing relationships? Jonathan Kanter, do you have any thoughts on that?
I like what Dr. Murphy is talking about a lot. I think it is really an opportunity right now to get back to some of the basic dance steps of relationships. And the basic dance step is, I think, exactly as Dr. Murphy put it, that people express how they really feel, something authentic, something vulnerable. And the other person responds well with listening, with understanding, with care. And right now is such a crucial time to go back to that basic dance step and to be having these conversations with people and really expressing how we feel. And this can be done in, I think, all sorts of ways. I think, in fact, we can learn from people who have struggled with mental illness. People say in addiction treatment, going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, they have learned over the course of their lives to count on and value these support groups where these sorts of exchanges happen. And I think now the mainstream is realizing that these things are important. So the more we can do this sort of thing, I think the better.
Well, let me get caller Melissa in here. Hi, Melissa.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call and so grateful for this program. My question, I'd like to hear a little bit more about how we can help. I have some immune compromised relatives, one of whom just had an operation. He's at home. But I'm trying to figure out how to assist in his recovery without, of course, getting in close to them. And we're in constant contact, so we do that. But I am now delivering groceries to them on their porch. And my biggest fear, of course, is that I might still be a carrier in some way. So I'm really weighing this and concerned, and I wonder if you can speak to that in general and that to specific.
Dr. Murthy, that sounds like a good one for you.
Well, first, I think it's so wonderful that you're taking care of these people in your life. There are so many people who don't have the ability to go out and get groceries, or where a simple interaction with somebody could put their life at risk. And so I really commend you on the compassion that they're demonstrating here. You know, if you want to reduce the risk to them, I think there are a couple of things that would be important here. One is ensuring that you are keeping your distance from them. We know that the closer you are in contact with somebody, the more easy it is to spread the virus through respiratory droplets, which can spread when we cough, when we sneeze, or even when we talk. So maintaining a distance of at least 6 feet would be ideal. And if you're just dropping something off at their door and then telling them so they can come out and get it, or speaking to them, you know, sort of across the way, I think that is safer. The second thing I would tell you, though, is it's incredibly important that you also are washing your hands before you go and handle whatever food you're preparing for them and the dishes that you may be putting it in, and certainly when you're bagging it and then delivering it to them. And third, I would recommend that if you have something that you can use to cover your mouth and your nose, a bandana or something of that sort, that may prevent you from, or reduce the risk, I should say, of spreading any respiratory droplets to them when you are doing a drop off and interacting with them. Let me just be super clear on this point, though, because what I'm not saying is that everyone should go out and get masks, because what we need right now is we need to preserve these masks for doctors and nurses and healthcare workers, because we have a real shortage right now in the United States. And people on the front lines are getting sick and are dying because they do not have the protection that they need. And it's a travesty that this is happening in the United States of America, but it is. And until we solve that problem, we should prioritize masks for them. But you can place another cloth or something, you know, around your face to protect you or to reduce the chances that you spread something to them as well. So these are some small steps that you can take. But I would also say that in this age where we're really focused on the risk of infection, it's also really important to emphasize the benefits of human connection, and that what you are doing and helping them feel cared for and loved and supported goes a long way to also supporting their health.
Well, this listener wants to know how to be a romantic partner while apart, dating while apart. What are some ways to handle this? Any thoughts, Lydia Denworth?
I have some friends who are doing virtual dating, first dates virtually, which is an interesting concept. And so maybe that, I don't know very much about how that's happening, but I think there's might be an opportunity here to, I mean, if you look at it that way, to get to know people in a different way. I actually have two friends who are now married for a long time, and they did meet in person at a party, but then they lived in different countries, and they conducted their romance through emails. And when they got engaged, he had printed out the 1,000 wooing words, he called them, of all the emails they'd written each other. So there is a way of getting to know each other by having to write or by interacting in other ways that that can call for some creativity and some innovative approaches. I don't think people have to imagine that their dating lives have to end entirely, even though they obviously will be radically different in this time.
Well, let me go to Jerry in San Francisco. Hi, Jerry.
I apologize, my voice. I have Parkinson's, so I do the best I can. By the way, thank you, KQED. I was on the board there for 7 years and chairman of one of the committees.
And
I really appreciate what you're doing. I really appreciate what you're doing and continue to do. I'm in long-term care facility, and we had a creative writing class, which is very important to us, every Thursday. And when this thing happened, I thought we were going to lose it. And the administration here, along with Claudia Duffy, a teacher, got together and made it away for us to conference call each other every Thursday. So we meet every Thursday at 11 o'clock, not together, but on the phone. We kept the class and we kept the friendship intact.
So conference calling each other in a long-term care facility. Thanks, Jerry, for sharing that.
Yeah. Thank you, KQED.
And thanks. Well, we appreciate that your the role that you had with us as well. And let me see if I can get Michael from San Francisco in here next. Hi, Michael.
Hi, good morning. I'm enjoying the conversation, and I just wanted to reach out to Pamela as far as being scared about asking neighbors for, you know, Wi-Fi access, things like that. Don't. Just go ahead and knock on their door and then step back. And my neighbors and I are pretty tight. I'm looking at some of them right now. And, you know, we keep our distance, but, you know, don't be afraid to ask for, you know, assistance if you need it. We are, you know, having difficulties, obviously, and my mother-in-law is in an assisted facility, and we can't visit her because they're in lockdown, but we still contact her and make sure she's okay. So, yeah, don't be afraid to go and knock on people's doors and say hello. Go for a run, that sort of thing. It's sad, but, you know, I agree with Dr. Murphy about, you know, social distancing, but you could still say hello and wave at people and have conversations.
Michael, thanks. Another recommendation, Dr. Cantor, has been to indulge in a little nostalgia. I read that one. What does nostalgia have the potential to do? And is that a good thing to do, to think about better days or previous pre-pandemic days?
I think talking about positive events, positive experiences happening right now currently, as well as in the past and in our distant past, is actually a really beautiful and important thing. And there's some really nice research on that as well. It can be a really valuable way to connect with each other. There's this wonderful resource that many people may know about. It's called the 36 Questions, and you can Google it and find it, I think, through the New York Times website. And it's 36 questions that people can answer together. This could be for online dating. This could be for people in the long-term care facility. This can be for people stuck in the house together. And many of those questions, well, at least some of those questions are about nostalgia and positive experiences, and then others are more difficult. And it gives people lots of options for how to talk about things in ways that really matter right now.
I remember those questions. Well, our producer, Susan, just let me know that there's a listener who wanted us to repeat the tech exchange number, and that number is 510-866-2260. Dr. Murthy, I want to end by asking you about this point you made that we should practice moments of solitude, even as we're isolated or alone. So how is solitude different from that? What should we be practicing when we're practicing solitude in these moments, whether we're with a lot of people in our household or alone?
Well, solitude is not the same as loneliness. We may be alone in the sense we may not have people around us, but solitude is actually a welcome state. It's a joyful state. And the reason solitude is so important is because it's in moments of solitude that we process so much of what happens in our lives. It's where we make sense of things consciously and unconsciously. It's where we allow the noise to settle, the noise of the modern day world, which can be quite loud at times. And we allow ourselves to reflect on what's actually happening in our lives. Our time for solitude has been edged out. This is an opportunity for us to reclaim it and to use it to reflect on the relationships that we have, the relationships we want to build. And if we do that, you know, I think that we can come out of this much, much stronger with a greater appreciation for human connection and the role it plays in our life.
Well, Kathy writes, I'm a care manager and have several clients in a retirement community and they're sheltering in place, so I can't visit. The social worker of the community sent a selfie with my clients yesterday and it made me so happy to see them. I sent one back of me and my dog. We have to connect. So selfies, another way. Well, Dr. Vivek Murthy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Mina.
And Jonathan Cantor and Lydia Denworth as well. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.